I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
After spending hours in the air on July 12th, 1949, 32-year-old Karen Marsh finally managed to get herself comfortable. She leaned back in her seat and looked out over the clouds. Soon she would be back in Los Angeles. The thought made her smile, and she closed her eyes. But just as she was drifting off to sleep, she was jolted awake by some turbulence.
Her nap ruined, Karen turned back toward the window. She could see the sun rising over the cloud bank, but her view of the San Fernando Valley below was obscured by fog. The plane began its final approach and descended into the mist. Karen watched the condensation collect on the glass.
Through the fog, Karen could just make out the silhouettes of hills in the distance. Then she realized, with alarm, that the hills weren't in the distance. They were right in front of the plane. They were flying much too low. As she watched, the right wing of the plane clipped the side of the Santa Susana Pass and burst into flames.
Karen was thrown out of her seat as the plane skipped off the side of the rocky hill and crashed to a halt 300 feet away. The right wing completely sheared off, and both flaming engines tumbled down the slope.
The fuselage flipped over, and the belly of the plane ripped open. The last thing Karen saw was the plane being torn apart before everything went black.
When she came to, the plane was on fire all around her. She looked down at her feet in a daze. One had been crushed by an airplane seat. The sight almost made her sick, but she forced herself to move. She crawled through the flames and out of the plane, past the lifeless bodies of her fellow passengers.
When she emerged from the wreckage, she thought she must be dead. In front of her was a man who looked like an angel. He ran around barefoot, tending to the survivors, his long hair and robes whipping in the wind. But the man was no angel. He was Krishna Venta.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults, a Parcast original. Every Tuesday, we look at a cult's practices, their leader, and their followers. You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Cults for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Cults in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help.
Last week, we followed Krishna Venta and his religious organization, the Fountain of the World. He eventually settled in a secluded canyon near Los Angeles in 1949 with nearly 200 devoted followers.
This week, we'll hear how the organization operated out of the canyon and built a cooperative community with the locals. We'll also take a look at Venta's controversial teachings and how the cult came to an explosive end.
Krishna Venta claimed to be many things: a philosopher from another planet, an ancient prophet, and even the embodiment of Christ. In reality, he was just Francis Pankovic, an orphan from San Francisco.
Venta was born in 1911 and later adopted by a family from northern Nevada, where he lived until he was an adult. He spent the next 30 years as a nomad, traveling all over the country, giving spiritual lectures under three different aliases. He promised to change people's lives and give them the answers to happiness and fulfillment.
But over time, his gimmicks ran stale. The media stopped covering him and crowds stopped showing up to his lectures. In 1946, he decided to change his image yet again, this time touring as a prophet who went by the Master.
He embarked on yet another lecture tour and this time gained a small following. In 1949, he and his second wife, Ruth, bought 20 acres of land in Box Canyon, just outside of Chatsworth, California. There, they built a monastery and housing for their followers, who numbered close to 200 at the time. Venta called it WKFL, Fountain of the World.
Venta's acolytes were totally devoted to him. They believed he had traveled all over the world searching for them. He claimed they were part of his 144,000 chosen elect, who would save the world after the fallout from the impending World War III. It was a cult of love and of fear.
Venta told his followers that the end of the world was fast approaching. His elect were on Earth to do good works to save everyone else. They were charged with caring for people from all over the world, and Venta hoped those they helped would, in turn, be attracted to the fountain's cause.
To spread the good word, Venta's followers spent a significant amount of time volunteering throughout Southern California. They cleaned up beaches, spent time at senior citizen homes, and donated food to those in need. They became well-regarded locally. But Venta's message didn't just focus on love. He also preached terror.
Venta told his followers that because Black Americans were treated so poorly in the United States, there would be a race war in 1965. He convinced them that the conflict would weaken the United States, giving the USSR the opportunity to strike, bringing about nuclear Armageddon by 1975. Though the U.S. would lose the war, the fountain would remain safe in their canyon.
Years later, Venta and his followers would reemerge to spread the word of God and bring down communism through religious revolution. He claimed the fountain would end the era of man and usher in the era of God.
Vanessa is going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or a psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. Kenneth Pargament, a professor of psychology, explained why someone might be attracted to a cult obsessed with the end of the world. He said the beliefs and practices of the cult provided a way to achieve significance of various kinds, a sense of hope for the future, feelings of worth and importance, a sense of meaning in life, or feelings of spiritual connectedness.
In post-World War II America, many felt aimless after witnessing the horrors of war, while others felt a strong sense of nuclear paranoia. As someone who spent his youth traveling around the country looking for meaning and belonging, Venta understood their feelings.
But his doomsday predictions were only the beginning of his radical teachings. He also taught his followers that when he was 3 years old, his body had been taken over by Christ, which then made him his embodiment. Venta was God, there to love mankind and calm their fears.
He claimed to have the knowledge of someone who had been alive for thousands of years, and that he originally arrived on the planet on a spaceship that was now hidden at the base of Mount Everest.
His doctrine incorporated ideas from different religions, sciences, and science fiction, but his key tenets were pretty simple to understand. Members chanted, meditated, and read the Bible. He wanted his followers to forget the ways of the world, know one's self, and love all things to fulfill the laws of God.
Despite his fascination with science fiction, he didn't teach any real science to his followers. He claimed that all illnesses were caused by the mind and said they didn't need to seek medical attention when they were sick. Instead, the illness could be cured through simple meditation and understanding.
Venta also required that his followers give their earthly possessions to him. In one case, Peter Kamenov, a Polish immigrant, gave up nearly $3,000 worth of assets when he joined, which today would be worth nearly $30,000.
Venta put this money to use quickly. By late 1949, he had built several structures in Box Canyon. This included a large two-story stone monastery and a dormitory for his followers. On the land, the fountain planted crops and claimed to be self-reliant, though they were still connected to the power grid.
When fountain members weren't volunteering in the community, Venta demanded they work and live full-time at the commune. There, he gave daily lectures to his followers.
Venta kept traveling all over the world, trying to spread his message and recruit new followers. When he went on lecture tours, he left his people behind in Box Canyon, where they worked 8 hours a day for no pay.
Instead, they were compensated with room and board, vegetarian food, and small dorm rooms. They were expected to take joy in simply doing the work of Venta.
The master took full advantage of the control he had over his followers. He knew they looked up to him as the savior of the world and were willing to do whatever he asked of them, even as they toiled away in austere conditions.
Venta's control even extended to members' personal lives. They only got married if he allowed it, and only on one day a year, his birthday, March 29th. Marriages came with large stipulations, however. They were seen strictly as a spiritual venture. Each union Venta performed was supposed to be non-sexual.
Of course, Venta himself did not abide by his own teachings. While he lived in Box Canyon, he and his wife had a total of 6 children.
There were also rumors throughout the commune that Venta was taking a special interest in pretty young female members of his cult. He held one-on-one teaching sessions that made many in the camp suspicious of Venta's true motives.
Even so, no one at the compound was willing to call him out. They were too invested in the cult and its message to speak out against their leader. His followers believed that he was Christ incarnate and could do whatever he wanted to do.
Venta certainly did whatever he wanted to. While everyone's time and effort went into the church, Venta was the only one allowed to spend the donations the group gathered. It wasn't unusual to see him speeding around the Southland, driving a new car while smoking an expensive cigar. He lived large on the backs of his followers.
But the Fountaineers, as his acolytes became known, still didn't complain. Instead, they emulated Venta, donning robes, going barefoot, and growing their hair out just like him. They abandoned their surnames and were given biblical names by Venta, or else went by brother or sister.
While Venta still traveled all over the country, he spent more time in Box Canyon as the months passed. He was putting down his roots and looking towards the future, but his past eventually caught up with him.
8 years before, in 1941, Venta's first wife, Geneva, had left him. The court awarded Geneva custody and child support for their 2 children in 1944, 3 years after their divorce. Venta was granted visitation rights. He spent time with his children, but he never paid up. He claimed not to believe in divorce, and as such, refused to pay the support. Geneva had left him, not the other way around.
Needless to say, the court system did not agree with his assessment. On June 17, 1949, Venta was arrested after Geneva filed a complaint in San Bernardino. Several of his followers gathered outside the jail to picket his arrest. He was detained for a few hours, then released when his second wife, Ruth, arrived to pay the $500 bail.
But before the suit could go to trial, Geneva disappeared and the charges were dropped. The district attorney worked to get in touch with her after the complaint was filed, but she never answered. She was possibly too scared to pursue the case after she heard Venta's faithful followers chanting outside the jail.
News coverage of Venta's arrest soon spread around the local community. It was the first time most people in the area had heard anything overtly negative about Venta. He didn't want bad press to give his neighbors the wrong idea and turn against him.
While many in the community saw his group as a cult, there was no negative stigma attached to the fountain at large. To the locals, the Fountaineers were quirky for sure, but they were not dangerous, and Venta wanted to keep it that way.
He racked his brain, wondering how to improve the group's reputation. Then, on the morning of July 12, 1949, Venta got his opportunity. At 7:45, there was a loud explosion in the canyon. The ground briefly shook, and Venta ran towards the source of the noise. He found a mangled plane engulfed in flames.
He then did the only thing there was to do. He rushed forward to help. Without any shoes on, he and two other followers navigated the rocky slope up to the crash site.
It was a grim scene. Most of the passengers had been killed upon impact. A few survivors had stumbled out of the plane in shock, unsure of what they had just experienced. It only took a few minutes for the local fire crew to arrive.
By the time reporters got there to snap pictures, the smell of burning fuel had filled the canyon. In the middle of it all, journalists saw Venta, clad in his robes, wearing a headband, helping a survivor down the steep hillside on a field stretcher.
Unfortunately, 35 of the 48 passengers of Standard Airlines Flight 897R died, including two children and both pilots. At the time, it was the worst air disaster in California's history.
It made headlines everywhere. And there, on the front page of papers all over the country, was a picture of Krishna Venta helping those in need. This one story gave him more media exposure than any of his previous stunts combined, allowing him to reach more potential followers than ever before.
Up next, we'll hear how Krishna Venta capitalized on his good publicity and how his demons caught up with him once again.
Thank you so much for listening. We want to take this time to tell you that Cults will be taking the next 2 weeks off. We'll be back with a brand new episode on January 7th. In the meantime, we do have a special gift to share with you. While we're away, we'll be airing our listeners' most requested episodes of 2019. If you'd like to check out the most requested episodes from Parcast's other shows, subscribe to Parcast Presents to hear our best of 2019. From everyone here at Parcast, we'd like to wish you a happy holiday season. We're thankful for your support and look forward to bringing you even more unique and entertaining podcasts in the new year. Thanks for listening.
Now, back to the story.
In July of 1949, 38-year-old Krishna Venta, leader of the Fountain of the World cult, was a first responder in the worst air disaster in California. His image was reinvigorated by the media coverage of his heroism. That September, he embarked on a recruitment binge. He announced a tour to find the most righteous city in the United States.
In his most recent lectures, Venta claimed the Fountain had thousands of members all over the world. These numbers varied city to city, but in reality, at the time, he only had about 175 devoted followers.
But only 2 months into the tour, after he traveled through the Midwest, he arrived in Chicago to a tepid reception. Venta searched for a place that would allow him to give his lectures for free, but he couldn't secure a location. He sent out a few followers to Indianapolis, but they were also unsuccessful in finding a venue.
None of the local media were under his spell either, and they were critical of his teachings. It didn't take a local reporter long to find out about his criminal past and his real name, Francis Pankovic. Venta abruptly ended the tour and headed back to California.
In the past, Venta had done anything it took to get his name in the headlines. Where once he had tried to perform high-profile publicity stunts to get attention, things had to change.
He had a following now and needed to do a better job of manicuring his image. Venta realized that he needed the media to focus on the Fountain's good works in order to mask his problematic past.
A few months after Chicago, in January 1950, Benta required all of his followers in Box Canyon to be trained by the Red Cross so they could be prepared for any future disasters.
In August of 1951, the canyon faced such a calamity. A brush fire erupted in Santa Susana Pass a few short miles from Box Canyon, and Benta had his followers set out to extinguish the blaze.
Firefighters were shocked when they saw a horde of barefoot men with long flowing hair and robes helping them. Benta may have realized this would be a great opportunity for publicity, or he may have only been concerned for the safety of his own compound. Regardless, the venture was a success. The fountain saved their land and were talked about all over the Southland for their firefighting efforts.
He began pressing his followers into doing more public works of good on his behalf. He said, "No minister on earth can save your soul. We are the only ones who can save it, and we can do it by doing good."
From then on, whenever a fire broke out in Southern California, Venta and the fountain volunteered their time to the cause. The local fire crews didn't complain. The fountaineers never got in the way. They were friendly, and most of all, they were helpful.
Venta knew from experience that the media would make or break him. He had been on both sides of the coin in the past 10 years, and he was determined to have it land his way again.
His next big opportunity came on July 21st, 1952. At 4:52 a.m., a 7.3 earthquake rocked the southern portion of the San Joaquin Valley, about 100 miles north of Box Canyon. It was one of the largest earthquakes ever recorded in the region.
The small city of Tehachapi was most affected by the quake. According to the Los Angeles Times, at least 11 people were killed, 35 people were injured, and over 130 homes were damaged.
Venta and the fountain sprang into action. According to a former member, Venta paid to have a nurse and rescue workers go north to help out.
Venta also arrived with hundreds of cots to help those who were now homeless. A picture of him and Sister Ruth talking to Red Cross workers was printed in local papers, accompanied by stories of disaster relief.
These were instances where Venta actually practiced what he preached. He was often right beside his members on the front lines, helping wherever he could. But in private, he remained a complicated individual.
While his actions resulted in some public good, he was basically leveraging natural disasters and tragedy to further his personal agenda. He also exploited the labor of his followers to gain publicity, which he hoped would lead to more personal wealth.
Meanwhile, he was often very tough on his followers. At one moment, loving, and the next moment, cruel. He demanded they give their all to the fountain.
He knew the power he had over them, and if he didn't feel that they were doing enough, he let them know. He said, "I am your shepherd. You are the sheep. When I organized this, I wanted a heaven on earth. Why not give it your all?"
In one sermon, he accused his followers of being blinded, spiritually stunted, selfish, and ultimately of letting him down. Venta said, "What you do unto the least of these, you do also unto me. You spit on me."
These kinds of criticisms were crushing for the Fountaineers. They believed they were being told by the Savior of all humanity, past and present, their God, that they weren't good enough and had let him down. But Venta's high expectations may have actually helped the cult to thrive. Nigel Barber, a researcher in biopsychology, wrote that it's common for people within cult-like groups to become more obedient the more their leader places demands on them. He said, "The more demanding a religious commune was, the greater the level of cooperation it elicited from members, and the longer the community survived."
While Venta was living a good life thanks to his followers' hard work, not everyone from his past was happy with how things had turned out. Venta's first wife, Geneva, reemerged, still looking for her first child support check. It had been 9 years, and she had yet to receive a single cent.
In December of 1953, Geneva filed another suit against Venta. This time, before he could be arrested, he voluntarily appeared in court. He thought Geneva's demands were unfounded and felt that once the judge heard his side of the story, he would be let off easy.
He arrived on the footsteps of the Alameda County Courthouse barefoot, with his hair tied into pigtails, wearing his standard yellow robe adorned with a bright white sash.
Venta told the judge that since his organization required everyone to donate all they had to the cause, he had no money himself. He reasoned that, like his followers, he had given all of his wealth to the fountain and its members.
Geneva told the judge that Venta was making it all up. She claimed that Venta once told her he wanted to establish a cult so he would never have to work a day in his life.
The court case shed light on what Venta had really been up to with the Fountain of Life. While he might have been preaching that he was Christ, he was actually exploiting his followers and squandering their money. He openly admitted to the judge that he had taken many trips to Las Vegas, funded by donation money.
He also admitted to losing vast sums of cash. According to the Oakland Tribune, Venta took out small loans under the fountain's name and lost $2,900 gambling in Nevada. He was forced to work out a deal with the bank to avoid being jailed.
The judge ultimately didn't buy Venta's defense that he was penniless and ordered him to pay $50 a month for each of his two children with Geneva. Venta was just glad the story didn't generate national coverage, and he quietly filed an appeal on the grounds of religious exemption.
Despite the personal blow, Venta still sought to grow his movement. He continued to travel all over the country, spending his followers' money as they helped out whenever Venta said they were needed.
In January of 1954, the fountain assisted with disaster relief in Southern California after heavy rains and mudslides. The following month, they traveled all the way to Kansas to help those suffering from a long-lasting drought.
Despite the good works and success, patience was wearing thin for many members. Over the years, Venta's numbers gradually began to dip. Some fountaineers got tired of the grueling work or grew wary of Venta and his hypocrisy.
Because of the slowly shrinking numbers, Venta rarely kicked out members who he no longer wanted in Box Canyon. It took a large act of insubordination for Venta to expel anyone.
Even then, there was no formal eviction process or violent removal. The group simply stopped feeding the members it wanted out, hoping that they would take the hint and leave once they got hungry.
Things were made even worse because the fountain itself was on shaky ground financially. Venta's recruiting trips were less successful than they used to be. He was pulling in fewer members and fewer donations. Though the group was far from thriving, Venta still enjoyed his comfortable lifestyle and refused to compromise.
As such, he still refused to pay the child support that two separate judges had mandated he give to his ex-wife.
He was back in court on December 9th, 1955, after his appeal was thrown out by the Supreme Court of California. This time, there was an even more damning testimony from his daughter, who had changed her name from LaVenta to Mary.
Mary testified that she had once gone on a trip with her father and a few Fountain members to Colorado. There, she saw her dad take multiple trips to a local dog track. He won and lost thousands of dollars per race.
That was more than enough for the judge. He didn't buy Venta's claim of religious exemption and ordered him to pay the child support he owed within 30 days or go to jail.
But Venta still failed to pay the amount. On Friday, January 6th, he was given a 5-day sentence for contempt of court. Fountaineers picketed outside the jail, calling him a spiritual prisoner.
When he was released the following Wednesday, he left without an expensive watch he came in with. It now belonged to his ex-wife.
By April of 1956, 45-year-old Venta came to an agreement with Geneva and put the entire ordeal behind him. He had grown weary of the negative press in California and his restless spirit that had largely been dormant during his time in Box Canyon kicked into hyperdrive.
He wanted to find a place free from scrutiny, a place that was still wild. On July 26th, he and a few followers left on a plane for Alaska to go on a scouting mission.
They were looking for 2,000 acres of land in the Alaska interior. There, they envisioned a new compound for all of their current and future members to live.
However, Venta never permanently moved to Alaska. He had made enemies, and they made sure his final moments were in Box Canyon.
Next up, we'll hear about Venta's final moments and the fountain's remaining legacy. Now, the conclusion of our story.
In the spring of 1957, 46-year-old Krishna Venta, the leader of the Fountain of the World cult, stood overlooking a dense Alaskan forest. He wore a parka over his bright yellow robe to keep warm. For the first time in years, he had shoes on his feet. He had been all over the state looking for a plot of land to build a new commune for his roughly 150 followers.
Originally, Venta had been searching for 2,000 acres of land in the Alaskan interior, but eventually he dialed down his ambition after he realized the cost. He then set his sights on a 160-acre piece of land, 25 miles outside the small town of Homer on the Kenai Peninsula. There, he and his followers planned on starting a farm and creating a compound with 7 different buildings.
It was rugged, unforgiving country, but it would be a brand new start, away from the high costs of California, away from Venta's nagging past, away from the ever-prying media who were always waiting in the wings for him to slip up.
Venta decided to split up his followers to begin work on the new compound. About a dozen of his faithful were sent up to Alaska in October of 1957, while the rest stayed back in Box Canyon. Those who Venta chose to homestead in Alaska had no choice other than to follow his orders.
It was a slow process. Members slowly arrived in Homer, but their presence did not go unnoticed. The Fountaineers were different from anyone the residents of Homer had ever seen, and those in town were curious, but not all that concerned. Alaska attracted all sorts of unique people.
By December of 1957, there were 27 people living at a compound they christened Venta, including his wife and his 2 oldest children.
The master himself split his time between Alaska and California to make sure everything was running smoothly. He needed those in California to keep contributing to be able to afford the new compound in Alaska. He had them go door to door in the Southland, asking for donations.
Over time, more members were sent to Alaska, but many others were resistant to the idea. Some ended up leaving the fountain because they finally had enough. Those that went to Alaska found life to be incredibly difficult. In the bitter cold, they began to work on 6 small cabins and 1 large one for Venta and his family.
The winters were harsh, but the spring thaw was no better. A marsh appeared between their cabins, and members found getting a farm running nearly impossible. Several more members tried to leave Alaska.
Some locals in Homer, like Billy Choate, remember seeing members fleeing the compound penniless. They were intent on leaving Alaska, but couldn't afford a way to get home, and were forced to bum around Homer looking for any chance to get out.
2 members who did successfully leave were Peter Kamenoff and Ralph Muller, also known as Brother Elzebah and Brother Jeroham. They'd been in Alaska for about a year when they became fed up with the way the group was being run. Both their marriages were crumbling, and they blamed Venta. They believed that he had taken an interest in their wives and was sleeping with them.
Notions like this weren't unheard of. Former member David Lackstrom claimed to have heard that Venta was having sex with female members of the fountain out in the woods near the monastery in Box Canyon.
Back in California, both Ralph and Peter turned toward alcohol and picked up odd jobs around town. Their lives had been ruined by following Krishna Venta. Peter lost his wife and his initial $3,000 donation when he joined.
But despite the obstacles and growing dissent within the group, Venta continued his mission to move the majority of his members up to Alaska. Over time, the 80 followers on the homestead completed 6 different cabins for members, along with a 2-story, 4-bedroom house for Venta and his family.
In November of 1958, 47-year-old Venta flew down to Los Angeles to check on his members in Box Canyon. On the 19th, shortly after breakfast, he gathered all of those who remained in his diminished commune, about 40 followers.
Venta berated them for failing to generate more money and said he was furious with them all. He threatened to give them $10 and force them to leave for 3 months to think about their failure.
Shortly after he made this announcement, however, a wildfire broke out and Venta left once more to help out.
When he returned, he had changed his mind, but he was still on edge. It may have had to do with the money that was still required to get the Alaska homestead completely ready, or it could have been his dwindling numbers. They lost a third of their members since splitting the group between California and Alaska, and things weren't looking good.
Meanwhile, the 2 former members, Peter and Ralph, were still seething about their failed marriages and the betrayal by Venta, who they still believed had slept with their wives.
Privately, they talked about bringing the cult leader down. They had endured the troubling practices of the Fountain for years. They had seen the master tell other members they didn't need to go to the doctor. They knew he took their belongings when they joined, leaving them destitute when they left. They also believed he was sleeping with more women than just their wives. They felt he was a predator.
On December 8, 1958, they took their grievances to the State Department in downtown Los Angeles. They filed a complaint with Special Agent James Mulvey, highlighting all of their problems with the Fountain of Life and with Krishna Venta.
But Mulvey needed evidence. He told them, if you can get a confession on which I can prosecute, then of course I will.
So they went to work. The next night they bought 20 sticks of dynamite, a few blasting caps, and a lot of wire from a company that sold oil well supplies. When the clerk asked them what they were up to, they told him they would be doing some blasting.
They spent the next day preparing, anxiously posted up in a hotel not too far from Box Canyon. There, they recorded a 2-hour-long tape outlining their reasons for what they were about to do. Peter left a letter for his son, who was on the homestead in Alaska with his mother. He wrote, "I'm willing to give my life to free you."
After sunset, Peter and Ralph made their way a few miles up the winding road. They passed under the familiar sign that read, "Ye who enter here, enter in upon holy ground." Then they made their way up the path to the large 2-story stone monastery built into the side of a cliff.
It was past midnight when they approached Venta in his room. Brother Martin, a new member, heard a commotion and approached the building. He opened the door to Venta's room and saw 2 strange men arguing with the master. They certainly couldn't be members because they were wearing normal clothes and shoes. He said he had never seen Venta so angry.
He saw the 2 men holding a canvas bag, but quickly left because he felt he was intruding. According to Brother Martin, the 2 strange men hadn't been holding anything other than the bag. It seemed Peter and Ralph had left the tape recorder in the car. They had no intention of recording a confession for Special Agent Mulvey.
The last thing Brother Martin heard Venta say as he walked away was, "What do you think I am, a hypocrite?" A minute later, as Brother Martin was halfway up the path, his ears were pierced by a sudden roar. The roof lifted in the air and disintegrated as a blue and white column of fire erupted from the building. The 3 men inside were instantly incinerated.
A mile away, Dorothy Hamm was thrown out of her bed by the violent explosion. She stumbled outside to see what was happening. She saw flames cresting the hill and heard the screams of the survivors carried by the wind. She ran back inside to call for help.
When the fire crews arrived, they found the monastery completely destroyed. The explosion had sent debris spraying in every direction for hundreds of yards.
The roof of the dormitory had collapsed, trapping several young boys, including one of Venta's sons, in their beds. He later reported, "Everything seemed to catch on fire. Our beds, the walls, our clothes, and all of our possessions."
Remarkably, the boys in the dorm were able to escape and tried to put out the flames. But within 5 minutes, the entire structure was gone.
The blast then sparked a brush fire that quickly raged out of control. Local residents were told to evacuate as firefighters descended on the canyon. Venta's refuge was in chaos, and by the early morning light, it looked like a total loss.
Thankfully, first responders were able to get the upper hand of the blaze, and a few structures were saved. But the members in Box Canyon were left in complete shock.
In total, 10 people were killed in the blast, including 2 children, all members of the Fountain of Life. Even before the blaze was out, the media began to arrive in the canyon. Venta had made his last headline.
The only way his remains were identified was through a partial upper dental plate, recognizable enough to match records. As for the bombers, all investigators found were parts of a finger and a hand. They had carried out their own form of justice and killed 7 innocent people in the process.
Venta's wife, Sister Ruth, flew down from Alaska to be with her children and to bury her husband. She told a reporter that Venta had foretold of his own death and that she wasn't sad because she knew he would be reincarnated.
Venta, along with the other victims, was buried in Valhalla Memorial Park in North Hollywood on December 19, 1958.
Over the next few years, the group slowly lost steam. Without Venta to lead them, they were aimless. Ruth continued to live in Alaska with several other passionate members, but eventually they all left. In Venta's home in Alaska, a white chair sat in the corner of one of their rooms, wrapped in plastic, never to be touched. His followers were still waiting for their master's return.
Today, there is a Krishna Venta conservation area on the old site of the compound in Alaska. In the small town of Homer, there is even a bronze bust of a former member who stayed in the town until his death in 2000.
Venta's original Eden in Box Canyon continued to be sporadically populated by a few members who hung on to the hope that their master would one day return. By the 60s, the compound was in a slow state of decay, but even that didn't stop new people from coming by.
One such visitor was a young, scraggly man from Ohio who came to California to be a musician. He was greeted warmly by a few members who offered him a place to stay. They told him of their former master and his teachings.
They also warned him about the coming race war, World War III, and the apocalypse. Eventually, the young man moved on to another location just 5 miles up the road, Spahn Ranch, and amassed his own following.
He taught his acolytes about the coming race war, but instead of cultivating an image as a do-gooder, he was content with playing the devil. He called the war Helter Skelter, and through Charles Manson, the worst part of Venta's legacy lived on.
Thanks again for tuning in to Cults. We'll be back with another episode next Tuesday.
You can find all episodes of Cults and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Cults, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Cults on Spotify, just open the app and type Cults in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
Cults was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Freddie Beckley, and Joel Stein. This episode of Cults was written by Robert Tyler Walker, with writing assistance by Drew Cole, and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. Just a reminder that we'll be back with a new episode on January 7th. In the meantime, we'll be playing our listeners' most requested episodes of 2019. Thanks again for listening. We hope you have a wonderful holiday season.